Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. And now BNA welcomes Dr. Kristen Johnson to their team of audiologists. Dr. Johnson earned her Doctor of Audiology degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and her personal experience with a movement disorder adds a relatable compassion that fuels her passion for helping others. More information about Dr. Johnson is available at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's public media. The mother of a murdered McLean County girl says the state child welfare system failed her daughter and needs systemic change. Ann Simmons has started a nonprofit reform group called Justice for Rika. The move comes after Cynthia Baker received a life sentence in prison for killing little Rika Roundtree. Baker was Rika's father's girlfriend. In this interview with Edith Brady Lunny, Ann Simmons says there's a lack of resources to help at-risk families stabilize, and there's a risk and disincentive to contact government child welfare groups to ask for help.
But the people that we ask are these agencies and these systems, and then we get judged for asking. We get more problems than we started off with when we go to these systems. I want to provide a network of people that aren't going to judge you because you're dealing with an hardship. I want to be a second set of eyes to DCFS. How come DCFS has a right to come in and disrupt households based off of one person's opinion? That's not okay, because a lot of times there's a cultural disconnect. You don't understand my way of living, so I can't expect you to think that because my house is a little messy, I don't have certain foods, I don't follow the food table, or certain things aren't culturally accepted between the masses. I mean, children are being taken away from their homes because of that.
When we talk about placing children in other people's homes and checking them out to make sure these are suitable people, and if we go back to Cindy Baker's case as the example, she actually had two indicated child abuse findings against her in her lifetime. Why would any child be placed in her care given that she had a record of prior child abuse that was substantiated? And then you add five other investigations, several involving Rika, where they came up unfounded. What does that say, do you think, about the care that's taken in placing children in other homes to begin with?
In Rika's case, I think what happened was the circumstances. It's a divorce. It's a divorce situation. It's a situation where I have a criminal past.
Right.
And my criminal past affects the community. I sold drugs. I got a DUI. We can point the fingers at me because I'm affecting the community. However, what goes on in Cindy's house, that's what's going on in Cindy's house.
Right.
So they never took their glasses off or put their glasses on to look into what was going on in that house, because they were so biased by what I had going on the outside.
Right.
So even though I'm valid in saying my daughter is being abused, this woman is abusing my daughter, she's going to kill her, they don't look into that.
Apart from systemic change, what would you like to see in Rika's case?
I would just ask them to open up the case file, get a room of decision makers within their facility, their organization, different age ranges, different backgrounds. Give them all this case file and let them have their way with it. Let them go through what's in there and then come back and let them all tell you what they saw. Then pick up from there and try to repair it and fix it. There were so many things, from the spellings of the names that couldn't connect the case files, from birth dates. I mean, there were little things that could have connected everything, not to mention just flat out not doing your job. We're not going to investigate. We're just going to take it for what it is, and that's just it. Flat out just not doing your job. People need to be removed from their positions. They're responsible for murder. I don't even care. I'm just going to say it. They're responsible for murder. You had a job to do. Your job could have prevented the death of my child, and it didn't. You had a job. They're responsible. I just want them to be held accountable.
Well, okay, so who should be in that room when these decisions that they made are being reviewed? They have their own internal investigators who judge their own agency's workers.
In the beginning, when they told me that the abuse was unfounded, and I went to the supervisor at the time, he said, I stand by my work. That was it. He said, I stand by my work. I went face to face with him. He stood in the doorway at the DCFS building on Brown Street, and he flat out, I stand by my worker. I said, my daughter is being abused. I said, they talked to her for 5 minutes in the bus stop. That's the extent of the investigation, and you guys are going to unfound it? He said, I stand by my workers.
And this was before Rika died. This was after.
This was 2017. This is 2 years before Rika died.
That's Ann Simmons, the mother of the murdered child, Rika Roundtree. Rika was one of 103 children who died in the last year while involved in some way with the Department of Children and Family Services. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University is getting closer to beginning rapid saliva tests for the coronavirus among students, faculty, and staff on campus. The original goal has shifted to next semester. ISU testing czar and chemist John Bauer says some things have yet to fall in place, but a lot has.
We are getting the lab set up. We are actually hiring staff, and we have the laboratory supervisor is currently training at a SHIELD lab in Decatur, and then some of our lab staff starts next week. So we'll be doing some training and validation for the rest of December.
The earliest hoped for date to have the lab stood up and testing is about now. What's the new estimate about when testing can start to be rolled out on campus?
The lab should be pretty much set up and hopefully as long as the validation goes well, should be ready, able to do testing by the end of the December. Obviously, that's not a good time to get the testing started. So we hope the lab will be ready by early January. The ideal goal is to have it ready for the first week of the semester.
Are there still regulatory hurdles?
As far as we know, the EUA, the emergency use authorization, hasn't yet been issued by the FDA. And so that's one of the big regulatory hurdles.
Do you have an indication when that might happen?
I think everybody's hopeful it will be anytime soon, but you know, with these things, you're waiting for the FDA to act, and they've obviously got a lot of things going on right now, so nobody's willing to put a definite date on it for sure.
What's your current guidance on the amount of testing that you hope to be able to do?
So we are starting with a single shift in the lab, which should be able to do up to probably between 3,000 and 5,000 samples a day. So that if we do a 5-day week, you know, that works out to 15,000 to 20,000 per week. That would be our capacity running at full steam, really.
Will you need to add a second shift, or is that going to prove sufficient?
That's a good question. We are. It will depend on the demand. So we will likely be running some samples outside of ISU as part of the SHIELD system. And so it really depends on what demand develops through the SHIELD system.
Will this program beginning affect university decisions on how it holds classes, remote or in person?
I think those decisions have already been made. And so the ability to do frequent testing is basically a way to keep the campus safer rather than change any sort of teaching modality.
So it would not move to completely in person no matter what?
No, I don't think there's any discussion of that as far as I'm aware of.
What's the current accounting for cost estimates and money expended to get this program moving?
The cost for setting up the lab is being, that's part of the SHIELD business model. What we've incurred is essentially some lab modifications and starting to hire some staff, but a lot of that will be recovered through the SHIELD arrangement that essentially provides some cost recovery for running the lab.
Charges of per test.
Yeah. So the clients of SHIELD will pay a fee per test. I think it's between $20 and $30 is what they're estimating, and so that is what pays for the the lab equipment and staffing.
So that's more than previous estimates of about $10 per test, but still less than the $100 a test that the gold standard testing out at the Interstate Center is charging.
Correct. Yeah. I think our resolution that authorizes ISU to participate in the testing is the price is estimated to be $20 per sample.
What does the public need to know about this?
Well, I think we're going to be able to increase testing capacity and through make some additional testing available in the community, and it's not the antigen testing, it's the PCR testing, which is more accurate and higher sensitivity, and so I think it will help monitor outbreaks and keep the community safer.
The U of I has compulsory testing for students. That has not been the thinking at ISU. Is that being rethought, or will it still be voluntary testing?
We're still discussing the whether it will be required or not, and it really depends on the timeline of when it's available. So I think those discussions are ongoing, and we'll hopefully, before the start of the semester, we'll be able to answer that definitively.
If all goes well, you will use this testing center for a semester and perhaps a summer session, and vaccination will be widespread by the fall semester. Is that a little frustrating?
Well, as long as it has some utility and is able to keep, help us track infections and keep the numbers more manageable, I think that's a positive thing. Like anything with COVID, you just don't know what the future holds. And I think there's still some people that are thinking, even when the vaccine is available, college students are going to be among the last to get it. We don't know what the need, how long we'll need to do it. We have contingencies in case we need it in the fall. And if we're done sooner than we think, that's a success. But we sure hope we're able to do testing early in January and might be able to monitor any surge that might happen as people come back.
That's John Bauer, the director of the Coronavirus Testing Program for Illinois State University. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. A write-in candidate for Bloomington mayor says she can provide the servant leadership City Hall needs. Misty Metros is a teaching assistant at Bent Elementary. She works mostly with children who have special needs. Metros has been a Habitat for Humanity volunteer since she helped build her own Habitat home for herself and her two sons in 2011. Metros tells Eric Stock why she decided to jump into the mayor's race with no political experience.
I honestly just got tired of the way our leadership has gotten to, not just really nationally, but in some instances here locally, with just some of the things that were coming out, some of the things that are being pushed for in our community. I got tired of leaders who are elected, to lead, to serve the people, who have instead, served themselves or served themselves, served those who are allied with them.
What are some examples?
One of the things would be defunding our police. That just does not make sense. And you see what happens in these other cities, these actually much larger cities, when you have their city councils that are going for that are pushing for that as well, to, cut back on law enforcement, who's there, to keep you safe, to keep your businesses safe, to keep your home safe, to keep your streets safe.
Where did this come up that you saw that the city was somehow pushing this, or someone in city leadership was actively looking to bring this movement about that provoked this discussion for you?
So this would have been back in spring or summer. I remember reading about Mayor Renner referring or mentioning our militarized police. Then you have Councilwoman Perillo, who has been vocal about also defunding the police.
Are there other examples of this where you feel that city leaders have not shown the leadership that you are looking for?
I look at also, say, the recent gas tax. So the city was talking about, you know, increasing the gas tax again. It was 4%. And I believe it was the city manager, Gleason, who had mentioned, because the money was supposed to go for the road. And he had made a reference to, well, the people want the road fixed, but, you know, they don't want to pay for it. And I remember thinking, well, what is all this money that we've been paying for in taxes all these years going for if the roads have been left in the condition they were in, but you need to raise taxes again? So what happened to those funds before that the roads weren't fixed? But now, you know, you want to raise taxes again to fix the roads.
Now, if we can take a look at your background, Misty, what background do you have that you feel prepares you to lead this city, a city of close to 80,000 people?
So I am a servant first. I think leaders need to lead by serving. So I want to help others. That's why I'm active as a volunteer. And so part of leading is you serve. You see what is needed. You see what is needed to help this city grow. And so I've been a volunteer for years. And then I've been working with children. You've got to have some sort of stability, some sort of a mental acuity, you know, to lead the different types of children in their various stages of growth. And throughout, you apply that on a larger scale to a city.
You were listed as a write-in candidate. Were you unable to get the signatures to get on the ballot, or how did that work out?
When I picked up the packet, the candidate's packet, it was a couple of days before the weekend. I think it was a Tuesday or Wednesday. And it was about 2 weeks before the 16th, you know, when the filing period opened up. So I started to go out that weekend, that Saturday and Sunday, to gather signatures. Well, that following Monday, I was told I had to isolate because I had been in close contact with somebody who had turned out to be positive for this abominable virus.
Misty Metro says she wasn't aware of the filing dates for Bloomington mayor until Terry Renner announced he wasn't running for a third term. Three candidates will be on the ballot next April: former McLean County Board candidate Jackie Gunderson, City Council member Mboka Mwilambwe, and entrepreneur Mike Straza. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bradley University graduate and social justice advocate Pierre Paul is leading a team working on a program to help hearing-impaired people. Paul is founder and CEO of We Hear You, a startup developing an app to translate American Sign Language into spoken English. In a conversation with reporter Joe Deacon, Paul says he came up with the idea a couple summers ago as he struggled to fall asleep one night.
And I always find myself having deeper thoughts at night, trying to conceptualize new ways to help the people around me. And just kind of give a little bit of backstory. So when I first came to the United States, I was bullied and just disrespected a lot for things out of my control. I had an accent. I was new to the school. I was a foreigner. I mean, I just remember as a kid thinking that I didn't want people to feel like an outsider inside of their own skin for things outside of their control. And the same kind of goes with individuals who utilize American Sign Language or individuals who are deaf or hard of hearing. They're speaking in their own language, and our society doesn't accommodate that. So with that in mind, I had the idea for the application of We Hear You, a device that turns American Sign Language into audible speech and then is backwards compatible to turn speech and text into American Sign Language. And with that, came to Bradley's campus, found some individuals who were able to make it possible. We'll be releasing it this December in the Spot Coffee Shop to test out, kind of get some trial runs in, see how it works in a live setting.
What else can you tell us about the We Hear You app itself? Can you describe a little bit about how it works?
Yes and no. So we're still getting some provisional patents on it, so I'm not going to be too detailed. But essentially, we have trained the system on a neural network, and we've also utilized some open source data that Google has made available So our system knows certain things that we've taught it. So we just taught our system through training to recognize ASL letters and then turn those into words and then string them together so they make words. And then in the future, we're going to be training it on words. So full sign language with both hands can be recognized. And then full sign language with body language and facials will also be recognized.
You mentioned you're going to be doing some trial runs soon at the shop here in Peoria. Beyond that, what are the plans for getting the app launched and making it available to the broader community?
Yeah, so we've had really strong and good connections with Target. So the goal is definitely to have Target kind of guide us, seeing our application, help us develop our application, and then we want to test it inside of Target as well once it's a little bit more finalized. And then from there, we hope to expand We Hear You so this system is all over the place. And I guess a little insider secret for you. So I decided that I didn't want We Hear You to just be kind of like a one-trick pony or like a one-hit wonder. So there are a couple other inventions. I'm actually working on two other ones right now.
That's Pierre Paul, founder and CEO of We Hear You, a startup developing an app using American Sign Language and translating it into spoken English. He spoke with Joe Deacon. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker.